It is Sunday, August 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, the top U.S. diplomat tries to smooth relations with one of America's top Arab allies. Our State Department correspondent was traveling with John Kerry in Egypt and tells us how his meetings went. We'll preview President Obama's new initiative to combat climate change in the United States. And international athletes with intellectual disabilities compete in the Los Angeles Special Olympics.
They've worked hard the whole year to get here, getting themselves as fit as they can. And it just means everything to be representing their country.
It's all ahead on International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is on a Mideast tour aimed at trying to assure America's Mideast allies that the Iran nuclear deal makes them safer. Kerry met with Egypt's foreign minister and president in Cairo on Sunday before traveling to the Qatari capital, Doha. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins is traveling with the top U.S. diplomat. After she arrived in Doha, I asked Pam to describe the atmospherics of the U.S.-Egyptian talks, given the recent history of tension between the two sides.
The talks were very cordial. There was little, if any, hint of previous tensions between the Obama administration and Egyptian officials. If anything, this seemed to be an effort on both sides to move forward and look for areas of collaboration. This was a strategic dialogue, and again, it was a wide-ranging session. They spoke about security issues, economic cooperation, and human rights. On the security front, one focal point was the recent attacks in the Sinai, including some by groups that claim allegiance to the Islamic State. Kerry, in a joint appearance with the Egyptian foreign minister, said it does not take courage to conduct a terrorist attack. He says it does take courage to create a political process. The Iran nuclear deal was also part of their discussion today, in particular the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Kerry said if implemented, it would be beneficial for the region. In terms of human rights, the Egyptian foreign minister was asked about the country's human rights record and its detention of journalists in particular. He said there had been what he called misperceptions and a lack of information about Egypt's judicial system.
Well, I wanted to pick up on that point about Egypt's treatment of journalists. One issue that came up in that news conference between Kerry and his Egyptian counterpart Shukri was a report by the Committee to Protect Journalists that a number of journalists were detained recently in Egypt. I'd like to know if you noticed any issues with the way Egyptian authorities were allowing you to do your job and just what you've heard about the treatment of journalists generally in Egypt.
Well, that's an interesting question. And the foreign minister, when asked about the Committee to Protect Journalists report, he said that those journalists who had been detained were not detained for doing their job, but for other violations. And he mentioned even some affiliations with what he called terrorist acts. As for me, generally speaking, it's been a fairly normal experience. I have not experienced any kinds of restrictions in my reporting, but I did have an opportunity to speak to an Egyptian journalist who's based in Cairo, and he had a very different perception. He talked about a lot of the media outlets being regulated and one-sided in terms of what is reported. And he also talked about cases in which he had covered protests and demonstrations and had his cell phone seized by police who wanted to check to see what he was reporting on social media sites.
So you just arrived recently in the Qatari capital, Doha, with Kerry and his entourage. Can you tell us a little bit about what the U.S. top diplomat is going to be doing in Doha?
It's going to be a full day for Secretary of State Kerry. One of the main purposes of this trip is to meet with the Gulf Cooperation Council members about the Iran nuclear deal. Some Gulf members have raised concerns that the deal could be destabilizing to the region and that a sanctions-free Iran could lend more support to militant groups in the region. So part of this is part of the U.S. administration's efforts to allay some concerns about this agreement. Also, while here, he will be meeting with Sergey Lavrov, and among the topics that will be discussed is the unrest in Ukraine and also the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria.
Sounds like a busy day ahead for U.S. Secretary Kerry. Thanks very much to our State Department correspondent, Pam Dawkins, in Doha.
Thank you.
Turning now to Africa, in Burundi, the assassination of an army general on Sunday is creating panic and confusion throughout the country, according to an activist with the Burundian Forum for Strengthening Civil Society. VOA's Peter Claudie spoke earlier with that Burundian activist, Vital Nshimirimana, and asked for his reaction to the killing of General Adolphe Nshimirimana, a top aide to President Pierre Nkurunziza.
We have been noticing that there is an growing state of violence in Burundi. And this has been the case from the time when Nkurunziza announced his candidacy to the third term. So now that a senior officer in the army can be killed in the street, this is a matter of concern from the population because they all know that they are not protected.
Some people are calling on you and other people to petition the government to increase protection for the people.
It is their duty, it is the task for the government to protect all the citizens, including the ordinary citizens and the top officials in the administration, in the army, in the judiciary, and all the foreigners living on the national territory.
Has the government come out to say anything following the assassination of this army general?
The assassination of this army general was known early the morning around 10 a.m., so it is very early to have the official position of the government about the same. But we expect that the government should actually increase the protection of all Burundians and at some extent try to resolve the underlying causes of this violence.
Main opposition leader Agathon Rwasa has been elected as the deputy speaker of the National Assembly or Parliament. How are people reacting to this? Some people say that he has betrayed the people of Burundi who are opposed to the third term of President Nkurunziza. What are you hearing from the ground?
Rwasa did not explain to people his choice, and we deeply respect his choice. This is a political choice. But many are disappointed for during the fake elections, he concurred with other politicians to call for the boycott of the fake elections. So we are actually wondering whether he's supportive of President Nkurunziza, because Rwasa is one of the key opposition leaders opposing the third term.
And that was Burundian activist Vital Nshimirimana speaking to VOA's Peter Claudie. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
A I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. U.S. President Barack Obama is set to unveil new regulations on Monday aimed at cutting carbon pollution that comes from the nation's power plants. The goal is for the plants to reduce their carbon emissions by 32% below 2005 levels by the year 2030. I spoke a short time ago with VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman, and I asked him what are the main elements of the president's plan.
Michael, the Obama administration is coming out with new rules, new regulations, by which U.S. power plants, specifically coal-powered plants, would reduce their emissions by just over 30% from the levels that were recorded in 2005. And they would have until 2030 to do so. And this is something that the administration has been discussing for quite some time. But President Obama is coming out with this formally later Monday.
Any specific reason for the timing of this announcement coming out on Monday?
I don't know that there's a specific reason for it. What I can tell you is that there are many groups in the Obama coalition, you might say, who have had their backs scratched from those who wanted health care reform to those who wanted gay rights to move to the front of the line. Many different elements. But the environmentalists have always felt like sort of the forgotten stepchild. And now in the last 18 months of the Obama administration, it looks like they're going to be getting their due.
They want to have their time to be in the spotlight. So what has to happen for these targets for reduced emissions to actually be implemented?
Well, first of all, it would be the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, that would be at the forefront of this. However, the EPA is not going around to each and every power plant and directing them as to what they have to do. Rather, they are going state by state and telling states, this is what you must achieve by the year 2030. We're not going to tell you how to get there. We're not going to tell you line by line what you must do, but this is how you must comply by the year 2030. And they are leaving it up to individual states to go about crafting a plan under the assumption that individual states will do so in the way that is least economically harmful and most beneficial.
How much power do states have to push back on these regulations? Do they have no say whatsoever? Do they actually have some scope to protest if they want to?
Well, it wouldn't just be the states. It would be their representatives in Congress. Now, this is not something where the administration has to ask Congress for permission. The Obama administration has control over the EPA, and the EPA has a great deal of say as to what happens with power plants. However, if the Republican-led Congress were able to do so, it could pass a law overruling it, or a more likely route for them and for individual states that object to this is to challenge it in court, to challenge it in federal court, to say that this is an overreach of the federal government into individual states. They will make it a question of states' rights versus the rights of the federal government.
And that means potentially the Supreme Court getting involved at some point.
Potentially, if it were to go that high, yes.
The administration has been facing accusations from members of Congress who represent areas that have a lot of coal-fired power plant workers, that these regulations are really aimed at killing those jobs. How has the administration responded to such accusations?
The administration would argue that the effort here is not to eliminate anyone's job per se, that is not the goal of what they're trying to do. The administration would argue that they want cleaner air and to save the planet. And yes, of course, there will be some economic dislocation from certain industries that are targeted by these new regulations. However, the administration would argue that on the whole, there are greater economic opportunities by embracing a cleaner energy future, that this could be a net generator of jobs rather than a net loss of jobs. Of course, you have to understand that if you come from a part of the country like Kentucky, which is where the Republican leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, comes from, the state of Kentucky, which produces a whole lot of coal, the economic effects of this could be disproportionately felt in certain regions and certain sectors. And that's really unavoidable.
perhaps those are the places where we might see the biggest opposition to this. But thanks very much, Senate correspondent Michael Bowman.
Thank you, Michael.
Turning to the world of sports, the 2015 Special Olympics wrapped up its competitions in Los Angeles on Saturday, and the closing ceremony for the athletes with intellectual disabilities was due to be held on Sunday night. As VOA's Michael Sullivan reports, the athletes from around the world have shown what they can do through skill and determination.
From table tennis to handball, Special Olympics athletes have given it their best, and some will take home medals. Irish athlete Carol Catling earned a gold for table tennis, and table tennis player Oloyuni Sunday won a gold in his division. His coach, Ulawuyi Amo, says it took practice.
Yeah, we come from Nigeria, and, you know, before we come for this program, we have to train them towards these World Games. And I think this is the dividend of the training.
A 27-year-old Panamanian bowler, Cassandra Barletta, is here with her family. Her brother, Rafael, says she has the skill and focus to excel in her sport.
Thankfully, she's very good at it. And, well, she has competed in a lot of competitions around the world and also in Panama, national and globally. And she has done very well.
But it's not all about winning. Canadian bocce coach Donna Cade says what motivates these athletes is the thrill of competition and sense of pride.
They've worked hard the whole year to get here, getting themselves as fit as they can, and just it just means everything to be representing their country.
More than 6,000 athletes from 165 countries have participated in sports from aquatics to powerlifting, and this week of competition has let them show the world what they can do. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
For the first time, astronomers have discovered the chemical element lithium within material ejected by a bright nova or exploding star located in the constellation Centaurus. The team made their discovery through observations of Nova Centauri 2013 with telescopes at the European Southern Observatory's La Silla Observatory near Santiago, Chile. According to the researchers, their discovery may help explain why so many young stars have more of this element than is expected. The discovery may also provide clues to astronomers who are trying to understand the chemical elements that make up the stars in our Milky Way. Scientists say lithium happens to be one of the few chemical elements that were created by the Big Bang some 13.8 billion years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Bobby Christina Brown, the deceased daughter of the late American pop star Whitney Houston, is set to be laid to rest next to her mother's grave in New Jersey on Monday. A funeral service for Bobby Christina Brown was held on Saturday in Atlanta, Georgia, with family members and celebrities among the mourners. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Music's Ray McDonald about the mysterious circumstances surrounding the death of the 22-year-old Brown and what will become of her mother Whitney Houston's fortune.
The world was shocked by the death of Bobby Christina Brown recently. She was found face down in a bathtub, very similar to her mother Whitney Houston. Ray, this is eerie. This is really, really creepy. And January 31st is when they found Bobby Christina unresponsive.
Right.
And so now she's dead, and now it's like all the lawyers are trying to decide what to do with the estate because she was the sole heir to her mother's fortune.
That's exactly right. And beyond that, prosecutors want to try and figure out who, if anyone, was responsible for the death of Bobby Christina Brown, even though an initial autopsy showed no underlying cause for her death and no injuries.
Now, there was some question about a guy who was her half-brother or an adopted brother and then became her husband.
Nick Gordon.
Nick Gordon. Yeah, what's going on there?
Well, Nick's role in all of this is very nebulous, and I really can't say specifically that he did anything. I mean, he and Bobby Christina were together in her Atlanta-area home. He found her face down in the bathtub on January 31st. As I say, the initial autopsy didn't reveal anything, although prosecutors are treating it as a homicide investigation. There will be more tests to come. Bobby Christina herself her funeral will be a private affair, and then she will be flown to New Jersey to be buried alongside her mother, Whitney Houston. This has yet to play out, and I'm not exactly sure how it's going to play out.
And there's a lot of money at stake here. I mean, Bobby Christina was the sole heir of Whitney Houston's entire estate. Mm-hmm. Millions upon millions of dollars. Now, her grandmother, Sissy Houston, is still alive, as is her aunt. But according to Whitney Houston's will, everything went to Bobby Christina in a trust, I believe, right?
Everything went to Bobby Christina in a trust. And this is going to be a very tangled case. Legal experts are at odds over exactly how it will come out. But it's going to take a long time and a lot of money.
Now, where's her father, Bobby Brown, in all this? What role is he playing?
Well, right now, Bobby is just saying, you know, he's devastated by the death of his daughter. He tried to be at her side every moment that he could during her 6 months in hospital. I think Bobby is just so emotionally devastated right now that he really has yet to get his bearings.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. If you have any questions or comments about this, you can hit us up at VOA_music. That's our Twitter handle. You can also send a tweet to VOA_IE. Listen for Ray to count down the top 20 and the top 5 hits of the week. You can find that at www.voanews.com.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. My thanks to your director today, Tracy Carter, and the engineer, Kevin Fowler. You can find me on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Have a great week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Mongolia are home to many unique species of wildlife. Cooperation in protecting these precious natural resources is one of many outcomes of the good relationship between the United States and Mongolia. That cooperation increased this month with the signing of a sister parks agreement between the United States National Park Service's Yosemite National Park and the Mongolian Ministry of Environment, Green Development, and Tourism, or MEGDIT. U.S. Ambassador to Mongolia Piper Campbell and Ochirhuyag, Vice Governor of Hovsgol-Aimag, or province, spoke at the July 18th signing ceremony in the foothills of Mongolia's picturesque Khoridal-Saridag Mountains. They described the creation of the sister park relationship as an opportunity for U.S.-Mongolian collaboration in natural resource management, healthy habitat creation, biodiversity, and environmental education. At the ceremony, Tom Medima, Chief of Interpretation and Education at Yosemite National Park, signed the agreement on behalf of the United States. Director Tumursuk of the Ulan Taiga Administration and Director Tavabayar of Lake Hovsgol National Park signed the agreement for Mongolia. This newest of Yosemite's agreements involves 4 Mongolian wilderness areas: Lake Hovsgol National Park and Ulan Taiga National Park, as well as the adjoining Tangis Shishkad and Khoridal Saridag protected areas. Yosemite also maintains sister parks relations with the governments of Chile, China, and Germany. MEGDIT's Department of Protected Areas Management was founded in 2012. Its mission includes the preservation of Mongolian national and cultural heritage through conservation of its parks and protected lands. The Mongol Ecology Center, a Mongolia-based NGO, has worked with this department since 2011 and played a key role in facilitating the relationship between U.S. and Mongolian officials. Yosemite National Park was established in 1890 and celebrates its 125th anniversary this year. The Mongolian government established Lake Hovsgol National Park in 1992. Lake Hovsgol contains 70% of Mongolia's surface freshwater, about 1% of global total freshwater. In 2014, there were approximately 80,000 visitors. During this year's summertime Nadam Festival, however, there were more than 40,000 visitors over 5 days. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Mongolia, to help preserve the biodiversity that connects all peoples and all life on Earth.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.